So I'm going to be in the Torah portion mostly. And in order to understand everything that's going on in the Torah portion, you also have to read Deuteronomy 15. Because Deuteronomy 15 gives a whole bunch of details on how these various releases are supposed to take place. So you need to look at them together. I got virtually the entire talk from Rabbi Sacks, proving once again that even Daddy's smarter than I am. What he was talking about is the problem of social inequality. He starts off with the idea, which is true, that freedom creates abundance. People who are free of interference from random bureaucrats and random Chaldeans and random Midianites and so forth produce great abundance. And by the way, one of the things that occurs to me, the word that is used in our language for freedom is capitalism, because you can't demonize freedom. But boy, capitalism you can sure demonize. And really, all capitalism is freedom. You get to do in the marketplace and so forth, within the law, whatever you want. And that produces great abundance. And as I say, renaming it capitalism means that you get to demonize it and say it's all bad. So the problem there is, in that, some people lose out. Some of them are just incompetent. They're not very good at anything, and so they become poor. Some of them are sinful. They try and do things that are illegal or sinful, and that eventually catches up with them. Some cases, just bad luck. But the point is, when you have freedom, you have stratification. And that is absolutely normal and absolutely expected. It is not, however, always benign, because great wealth differences create power differences. With wealth comes power. And one of the things that people do when they get wealthy and they get powerful is they arrange things so that they stay that way. And by the way, if you don't believe that, just look at our society right now. You have all sorts of wealthy and powerful people arranging things so that they stay that way. And what God does is he reaches in and stirs everything up once every 50 years. And the thing that's really fascinating for those of you who have studied economics, and I am not an economist, I've taken, I think, one economics course, there is a thing called the Kondratiev wave, which is a cycle of business up and down. Guy Kondratiev was a Russian. He figured this out, and he showed it to Stalin. Stalin had him killed, because what he was saying was sort of contrary to communism. But the point is, you have a cycle that goes up and down. And the thing that Kondratiev discovered is that cycle varies between 40 and 60 years. Now, what do you suppose the average is between 40 and 60? 50. So what I'm suggesting to you is God, for his people, has set things up so that that cycle can be managed without calamity. That's what he's set things up for. Now, one of the reasons that they are going into exile, and by the way, Jeremiah doesn't go into exile, he stays in Israel. But one of the reasons they're going into exile is because they didn't do the stuff with Jubilees and Yovels, a seven-year cycle. They weren't doing it because the rich and the powerful arranged things so they stayed that way, and they didn't do the mixing that God intended to have happen. So finally, God looks at them and says, "Nyeh, Babylonians for you." The other part of the problem is that you wind up having more poor people than you have rich people. Just the way it works. And it is very easy for a demagogue to come along and convince the poor people that the reason that they're poor is because somebody is giving them a raw deal. And masses of people represent power. So you've got the wealthy who are powerful, because they've tried to set things up so they stay wealthy. But then you have some guy coming in from the side, and he's looking at all these people milling around without anybody to lead him. And he says, hey, follow me, because you guys are getting a raw deal. And what we'll do is we will go and get these rich people and we will level things back out and we'll give you all their stuff. That in 25 words or less is communism, socialism, all the isms. Various intellectual trappings around it, but basically the message is all you poor people, follow us and we'll give you all the stuff. So what God is setting up is he is trying to avoid all of that. He's trying to set things up so this mixing that happens periodically is done in an orderly fashion and nobody gets damaged in that process. But people who are powerful and wealthy don't want to give any of that up. Israel didn't do this, but that was the setup. Back to Rabbi Sacks now. One of the things that Rabbi Sacks says is when the powerful mistreat the powerless, God gets grumpy with them. So I'll read from Sacks. Economic inequality leads to inequality of power. The result is often the abuse of the weak by the strong. This is a consistent refrain of the prophets. Amos speaks of those who sell the innocent for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, who trample on the heads of the poor as on the dust of the ground, and deny justice to the oppressed. Isaiah cries, "Woe to those who make unjust laws and issue oppressive decrees, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless." Micah inveighs against people who covet fields and seize them, houses and take them away, and oppress the householder, the house, people, and their inheritance. So God is not impressed when people don't follow his instructions, because his instructions are designed so that you have wealth and social mixing, and it's done in an orderly fashion. So Sacks says there are three components to this in the Torah. The first one is political. That involves the cancellation of debt. Now, that's where you have to go to Deuteronomy 15, because it is not listed in our Torah portion today. What that is every 7 years, debts are canceled. Every 50 years, debts are also canceled. And furthermore, everybody gets his patrimony back. You get the land that God gave your family under Joshua. Everybody goes back to his land. So the next thing that happens is slaves are freed. And furthermore, it says in other places in Scripture, when you free your slaves, your Hebrew slaves now, every 7 years, you will set them up generously. In other words, you don't just kick them out and say, "All right, you're released, see ya, bye." You've got to provide for them from your fields, from your flocks, and from your wine press, so that when they get out into the world, they have something set up so that they can make a success of themselves. You give them a shot at being successful. And of course, restoring the land, what lots of people don't realize is the source of all wealth is ultimately the land. That's the basis of it. You know, Proverbs says even the king is served by the field, which is to say even the king in the palace depends on land to feed him. So that's your source of wealth. So putting people back on the land gives them an economic opportunity. Sacks' second point is psychological. Notice how often the word "your brother" is used in this Torah portion. What Sacks is saying is the way God has set it up, you are more likely to help out a member of your family than you are a stranger. So what he's saying is, you guys are all a family. You are all the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These are your brothers. So treat them as family, and when they get into trouble and when they get poor and so forth, lend them just like you would to a member of the family. And oh, by the way, when you lend them money, you can't take interest from them. Now, if you lend money to a stranger, a sojourner and so forth, yeah, interest is fine, no problem. But within the family, Israel, you're not allowed to take interest. You're not allowed to make them serve with rigor. You're supposed to treat them as family. By the way, Susan asked a question on Tuesday night, and this is a good place to talk about that just very briefly. We were talking about love your neighbor. And one of the things that our society has done is has taken the word love and turned it into something that it is not. And much of the Sunday church spends a whole lot of time obsessing over Greek in the New Testament. There's three or four words. Which word is he using here? And what does that mean? Remember, one of the things that I've said is, as cultures change, language drifts. So words don't mean the same thing to us that they meant at the time that they were written. So what I will suggest to you, as you read the Torah, where it says, love your neighbor as yourself, instead of love, substitute care. Care for your neighbor as you care for yourself. Care for his safety. So when you're building a house, put a parapet around the wall so he doesn't stumble off when he's drunk and fall and break his neck. When you're digging a pit, fence it off, just as you wouldn't want to walk into a pit in the middle of the night and break your leg. Take care for your brother as well. So as you're reading the Torah, perhaps care speaks better to our culture than love does. Now, don't get me wrong. Love is the word, and I'm not changing the Torah, but the way that we have messed up the word love, people have trouble understanding that. The second point is you treat each other as family. And then the third point he makes is theological. And the idea there is none of this belongs to you. And he starts off in Genesis 1. And he says, God says that I made everything to include you. Therefore, I get to tell you what proper behavior is. So then what we have in our Torah portion today, the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. You are strangers and sojourners with me. In other words, I own the land, you don't. And so when I tell you every 50 years to give it back to the people I gave it to originally, I am authorized to do that because it's my land, not your land. And similarly, if your brother becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not work him as a slave, for they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. You shall not rule over them ruthlessly, but you shall fear your God. You don't own them either. And so in Israel, slavery is not something you are, it is something you do. Periodically, when somebody gets into trouble, commits a crime, can't support himself, whatever, he will sell himself as a slave. That is for a specified period of time, up to 6 years. He may not be mistreated. In fact, other parts of the Torah says, if you discipline your slave and you damage him, you've lost him because you've damaged him. You can't do that because they are God's, not yours. In other words, a Hebrew slave in Israel simply had a job he couldn't quit for up to 6 years. And furthermore, it says, if your brother needs help and you look at the calendar, and it is 6 months to the cancellation of debt, and you know that rascal is not going to be able to repay you in 6 months. You just know it. You still lend. Nothing else. Perhaps God will change this guy's fortune and he will be able to repay you. But the point is, you treat him with care as you would hope you would be treated. Now, the Shabbat and the Shemitah and Yovel. Ron Dart, he's going through the Ten Commandments right now. I enjoy his program. This is in the wilderness now, after they've come out of Egypt. God says, don't gather on Shabbat. And furthermore, what I'll do is I'll give you a double portion on Friday so that you don't have to gather on Shabbat. Now, stop a minute and think about what he's saying there. I'm telling you to rest, and there's no faith required. I'm giving you the food up front. You don't have to have any faith that you're not going to starve on Shabbat because I'm giving you a double portion on Friday. And you still had people wandering out there on Shabbat looking for food. Some people don't ever get the word. The same thing is the case with the Shemitah year and the Yovel. What God says is going into it in the sixth year, I will give you a bumper crop so that you have enough to eat in the year when you can't work your land. And you'll have enough to eat when you start working your land in the eighth year, and the crop doesn't come in till the fall, you will have enough to eat through all that period, no faith required. You get it up front. So all I'm really testing you on here is not faith, but are you greedy? Are you going to take that bumper crop that I give you in the sixth year, you're going to stack it away in a barn, and then you're going to work your land on the seventh, and boy, I've got an extra harvest here. By the way, is there a parable about that in the New Testament? Oh, yeah. Some guy gets a bumper crop, and he says, ooh, I need to build bigger barns. Yeshua says the same thing. So the point of Yovel and Shmita is God is not asking you to take anything on faith. He is simply saying, I want you to do it this way, do it. And if you can't get past your own greed, what we're going to do is Babylonians again. And that's what Jeremiah says to the people in Babylon. You guys are going to be there for 70 years because you owe the land here 70 years worth of rests. And as soon as you've been out of the land for 70 years and the land has had its rest that you owe it, then we'll bring you back. That's one of the proximate reasons they wound up in Babylon, in addition to the fact that they weren't releasing their slaves and so forth. Now, releasing slaves and land shouldn't require any faith either. First off, let's say that you have been fabulously blessed and you're a very wealthy man. You're coming up on Jubilee and you got to get rid of all your servants, slaves, and you got to give your land back, which is what you've been farming for 40 years. You don't have to give back your money. All of this money that you have accumulated and all this profit that you've accumulated over that time is yours. So when we get to the next cycle, you can then turn right around and go back out and find somebody else's land to buy or lease, and off you go again. So the whole point here is every 50 years, God does a societal reset, and one hopes that the people who have been slaves, and you have been a slave to somebody who can afford to buy your franchise, which means that you have been working for somebody who's successful, and you've been working for somebody who's successful up to 6 years. One hopes you've learned something in that process. He may have had to grab you by the ear and make you learn something, but the point is, in that 6 years, one hopes that you have learned something, and then when he sets you out on the seventh year with enough stuff to get you started, one hopes that you have a chance to succeed. That's the whole point of the exercise, to prevent what we have in our world today, which is where you have great concentrations of wealth, and the people who are wealthy arrange things so that they stay that way. You have masses of people who are resentful and angry, and then you have demagogues who come in to that mass of people who are resentful and angry, and you wind up having revolutions and all that kind of stuff. What God is setting up here is a counter to that. So, one of the things that Sachs says, and I completely agree with, regard everything that you have as being held in trust for God. Now, you get to live off of it, don't get me wrong. You get to go buy snacks, it's okay. But you're holding it in trust for God, and that's what the parable of the talents is. That's what the parable of the mina is. He has left you and he's given you resources, and they are his resources, not your resources. That's what our Torah portion says. It is God's land, not your land. The people are God's servants, not your slaves. It doesn't belong to you. So Sachs started this with the story of a family, the Walls. I had never heard of him. The man was an extremely successful businessman. And a friend of his had said, I'd like to have my 20-year-old daughter work for you for the summer. So they're walking from somewhere and they pass a beggar. And Walt reaches in his pocket and throws something in his cup and walks on. The gal says, would you give me my salary early? He says, why? Well, what you gave him isn't enough to make a difference. So he gave her the salary early, and she went and dropped it in the guy's cup. Come payday, he said, I am not going to give you pay because I already have, and I do not want to rob you of the mitzvah. If I reimburse you, then what you have done has no merit. And at that point, he said to himself, I'm going to marry her because she has a better heart than I do. They did get married, and they gave massive amounts to charity. So he is quiet, introvert, reserved. She's bubbly and vivacious and so forth. And she has a better heart than he does, and he takes advantage of that. But the point is, he doesn't regard his stuff as his. He regards it as God's. And I am simply managing it during my lifetime. And as with any business arrangement, a manager is perfectly within his rights to live off of the money he's managing. That's okay. For example, Ken's son is a wealth manager, and he, every month or every quarter or whatever he does, takes a portion of the money that he's managing and writes himself a check. Absolutely okay. No problem whatsoever, because he's entitled to live off of what he is managing. So you go back to the parable of the talents, where the master gives his people according to his estimate of their capacity. So one guy he gives a lot, another guy he gives less than, and another guy he gives small amount, because you're really good, and I want you investing a lot of my money. You're okay, so I'm going to give you some of my money to invest. You're not quite so competent, so I'm going to give you a little bit. During that process, while he's gone, they are perfectly within their rights to live off of the money that they are managing. And the guy that has more money is going to live better. It's okay. Just as in this Yovel thing, when you give the land back, you do not have to give back the money that you have made in 40 years. That's your money. It's okay. But now the other thing is, you also have to regard that money as not yours. Just as the land isn't yours, the servants aren't yours, the money isn't yours either. You're managing it for God. And there's a passage in the New Testament that talks about that, for those of you who want to be in the New Testament. This is in two places. It's in Matthew and it's in Luke. Luke 12, 22. And he said to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you put on. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens, they neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse nor barn, yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? If then you are not able to do as small a thing as that, why are you anxious about the rest? Consider the lilies, they grow, they neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass, which is alive in the field today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? And do not seek what you are to eat and what you are to drink, nor be worried, for all the nations of the world seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. So he's talking about food and clothing and wealth and so forth. And if you go through your life regarding everything that you have got as being held in trust, God is not stingy with his wealth managers. So fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possession, give to the needy, provide yourself with money bags that do not grow old, with the treasure in the heavens does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. As you read that, it isn't saying that everybody needs to take a vow of poverty, get rid of everything, and walk around in sackcloth and ashes. I mean, if you're called to do that, by all means, go ahead. But that's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is regard what you have got as his. If you do that, that will guide your life, and he is not stingy with his money managers. He will make sure that you're in good shape.